Okay. Normally we have a home group member talk about sponsorship for 5 minutes, but tonight we have someone all the way from Washington, D.C., and I'd like to introduce Dave, and he will introduce the main speaker, Jason. All right.
Thank you. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is October 22nd of 2002, and Midtown's my home group. And thank you for asking me to speak on sponsorship. You know, first of all, I'd like to thank the group about that. And then, I was looking around the room, and I feel like they're like old friends here. You know, over time we like got to know each other, and it's not like I come here every week, but I've seen you guys often, you know, and we've all kind of seen each other grow, you know, and welcome to the people that are new, you know, I didn't know what sponsorship was when I first got sober. The only idea that I had of sponsorship was of NASCAR and the companies that sponsor people on their cars, you know, and so when I went to my first, AA meeting with the home group that I have now, they were like asking me if I had sponsor. You know, like it was a pretty big meeting for the middle of the week. You know, it was like 80 people or something like that. You know, and a lot of them were guys, and a lot of them came up to me and were asking if I had a sponsor. And I had no idea what they were talking about. You know, and Jason had picked me up that day, and he was driving me off. You know, and he asked me like. You know, he was just talking to me, and I was like, you know, can you be my sponsor? You know, and I still didn't really know what that meant, you know. I was just like, you know, I've had these questions asked of me, so let's just kind of get it out of the way so then I won't have to go back to another meeting and answer it again, you know. And that, I didn't know what I was doing at the time. That really, I feel like, saved my life and sobriety, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's one of the main reasons why I'm still sober, you know, because throughout, like, with being sponsored, and especially in, like, when I was really new, like, I didn't, you know, they talk about having, like, a spiritual experience here. Like, I didn't really understand that, you know, and I feel like I didn't know anything about the steps. And so when I got a sponsor and he started showing me how he lived the steps in his life and also kind of going through the book with me and kind of helping me, guide me through the steps, you know, like it was really like when he kind of like was my first introduction to a spiritual experience, you know. And it wasn't that he was my God, you know, it wasn't that he was anything like that. It was just like he was bigger than my head, you know what I mean? And him and the group that I, you know, my home group and stuff like that, were giving me like good orderly direction, you know, and it was, and it saved my life, you know, and I thought about drinking a lot when I first got sober, and you know, walking through the steps with Jason and going through the steps with Jason, it really like it started to help relieve me from the mental obsession to drink, you know, and I started to make a home here, you know, and shortly thereafter, I mean, like within like a couple months, I was like, he got me to sponsor this guy. I mean, I don't think got me to sponsor. This guy asked me to sponsor him, you know, and I had no, it was like, I didn't know what I was doing, you know what I mean? I just wanted to get to the meeting, really, you know what I mean? And I was just picking this guy up, and I was like, trying to get to the steps like as much as I had gotten through them. I had gone to like my first, I think I was about my fourth or fifth step, you know, like, and he was really belligerent, and, I mean, people would come up to me at the meetings and call me on the phone and just, like, yell at me, you know, because of what this guy did, and I was like, dude, you know what I mean, like, I'm just trying to, like, stay sober, you know what I mean, like, who cares about this guy, you know, and, like, and eventually, like, you know, he did some certain things, and then eventually he got another sponsor, and eventually left. But you know, like I stayed sober, you know, and it made me like, you know, it kind of stuck me here, you know what I mean? Like it helped me get sober, and it helped me, it trained my feet, you know, and since then I've been able to sponsor. I've been fortunate enough to like sponsor people, you know, and I feel like. I've you know, been off the beam, you know, I've been on the beam, and the main thing that, like, has really helped me is, like, you know, walking through this journey with Jason, you know, and I still, luckily, I still have the same sponsor that I had, you know, 6 years ago, you know, and it's really, like, I feel like they talk about, like, a fellowship going on, like growing around among us, you know, and I feel like that's really like what's happened with Jason and I, you know, like he's been able to like sponsor other people and within our, like, we have a big group, you know, and so like having our small like family, you know what I mean, like it kind of like gives me a center, you know, and people to talk to, you know, and I've seen them grow and stuff. And the guys that I sponsor, you know, we were just talking about this right before the meeting. Like, when I'm a selfish, self-centered person to the core, you know, and like throughout my day, I'm mainly thinking about myself. I mean, I try to get out of myself and like call somebody or something like that. But when my guys call me, it's like a little relief from the insanity that, you know, that plagues me. Like numb, like I'm just numb, you know, and like and so like it helps me kind of get out of my head, you know, and I've seen them kind of grow, you know, and luckily I've been able to stay with Jason this whole time, and I feel like he knows me the best, you know, and whenever I've been crazy, you know, I don't know what's kept me here. I know it's like a love and higher power, but you know, like I think the main thing that's saved me is like when I've been crazy is to call Jason up, you know, and it's only been through taking the steps and having that door open to a higher power and like remain teachable, you know. And so with that, I'll introduce Jason.
I'm Jason, I'm an alcoholic.
Jason.
Thanks, David, for that introduction. Almost sounded like you meant it. Just kidding. I'm just kidding. My sobriety date is December 21st, 1995. And Midtown's my home group, just like David, and just like a couple of guys that came out here with us. And thanks for coming out, guys, because, you know, it would have been a, you know, a crazy drive if it was just me in my head and a speaker tape, you know. So thanks for coming up. Some of you have heard me before. I'm sorry. I said I might make something up, but I'm not going to. You're just going to get my story. It was depressing as hell to me. Hopefully you'll find it funny. That guy that David sponsored was so freaking crazy. He was one of the craziest people to ever enter our home group, which is a really crazy group. And there's like 400 of us. I was in a sober house at the time, and not like an Oxford house, just like a bunch of guys that went in and split the rent on this five-bedroom house. And our house was kind of like known as like the crazy house in our group, you know, and which was great for us. You know, we often had new guys crashing on the couch. We had a ton of parties, and our house today is kind of like that. And there was another house that was just as active, and they had five other guys that were living there, and they were like four doors down from us in the middle of this nice upper middle class suburban neighborhood in McLean, Virginia, which is like home to the Kennedys and, you know, a lot of other wealthy people and the CIA, incidentally. And one of my current roommates today, who was living at this other house a few doors down at the time, had like a van that was broken down with like the windows blacked out with those curtains. You know, it was like one of those big Econoline vans. And David's Pigeon lived in it for a couple of weeks. So like people are like coming out of like their suburban houses and they've got like kids riding tricycles and like, you know, they're getting the paper and having their coffee in their robe, and like this like crazy guy gets out of like the van and just like, you know, like yawns and like brushes his teeth and spits on the curb and gets back in the van, takes a nap. We didn't get that lease re-signed that year. I don't know why. But you know, that's AA, and it was a lot of fun. You know, there's, you know, room for all kinds, and that guy really helped you, you know. And especially the people that I've sponsored have really helped me. My story is very, like I said, a little depressing, and pretty garden variety. You know, I'm a garden variety drunk, just a regular alcoholic. You know, nothing special. But somehow I found a way to not drink for over 13 years. You know, and not all of it has been comfortable, and it hasn't all been, you know, like a roller coaster ride. But it's the best life that I've known. And I grew up in a regular neighborhood, very middle class, in the middle of suburbia, in Columbia and Ellicott City, Maryland, which is, you know, pretty average, right outside of Baltimore. And I come from a good home, good family. My parents got divorced when I was real young. It has nothing to do with my alcoholism. In fact, I never knew anything different because I don't even remember it. But my whole life I grew up with my mom and my stepfather, and my dad always lived separate from us, but he got us on weekends and picked me up all the time. And, you know, so I was always an active member of my life. You know, I never wanted for anything when I was a kid, you know, as far as material things or emotionally. You know, I mean, I grew up my whole life. I never had to wonder if my parents loved me, because they told me all the time. My dad told me, my dad and I are very close even today, and we talk all the time, and you know, it's, we never get off the phone without saying I love you. And it was like that my whole life growing up, you know. So I come from a good home. You know, I have a good family. I'm just the screwed up part, you know. You know, as far back as I can remember, even when I was a little kid, you know, I mean, like 6 and 7 and 8 years old, I always felt different from other kids. I always felt like somehow set apart or separate from, you know, and that was okay when I was young, you know, but somewhere along the line I developed this tremendous self-consciousness about that, you know, but it went from being different from everyone else to feeling less than everyone else, or worse than, or you know, excluded. Nobody ever excluded me. You know, I mean, well, sometimes they did actually, but it was much worse in my head than it was in reality. And you know, as far back as I can remember, there was this big divide. There was everybody else, and then there was me. You know, and I hear a lot of people in AA talk about that. You know, I don't think it's necessarily the defining factor for alcoholism, but it's very, I think it's very common. And I always felt like there was something missing, you know. And it wasn't a social anxiety problem, because I could be totally alone and still feel that way. You know, and that's today. You know, I mean, I don't need other people around to feel uncomfortable. I can just feel uncomfortable totally by myself. You know? And that's what I was like when I was a kid growing up. And so I started to get messed with and teased and picked on. You know, I was kind of a nerdy kid. Not like a nerdy kid who studied a lot and got good grades. I was a total failure in that area too. I failed out of school in like elementary school. You know, I was getting put in special classes and put on Ritalin and later antidepressants and sent to therapists and counselors and the principals. I lived in the principal's office, vice principal's office, knew the secretaries. You know what I mean? Napped on me on the couch. You know, I mean, it was just like that growing up. But none of that stuff made me cool at all. And I can remember getting on the bus in the fourth grade, and I had just transferred from Catholic school, where you kind of wear uniforms, and I didn't know I was dressed like a nerd, but apparently I was. And this guy named Chad Reagan said to me, not that I'm holding a grudge, that was 21 years ago. People were wearing Bugle Boy jeans. That's how long ago it was. No offense, Steve. But this guy, Chad Reagan, said to me, "Hey, new kid, where did you get that backpack?" And I said, "Kmart." You know, not thinking there was anything wrong with where I got my backpack. You know, but then I found out, and he was like, Kmart, and it was like every head on the bus was like, shoo, you know what I mean? And I was like, shit. And this is my first day of school, and I was already singled out as being a loser, and so people started calling me the Kmart kid. You know? I could almost cry, you know, right now if I think about it. Call me the Kmart kid for 2 years. You know, and, most of the kids in my school didn't even know my name. You know. And that's not what makes me an alcoholic, in case you're wondering. But I was pained by it, and I had a couple of older stepbrothers, Ryan and Mike, and an older brother, Dave. I love these guys. I looked up to them my whole life. I kind of was always following in their footsteps, and they started to become troublemakers. You know, and troublemakers, like if your hood ornament was missing in the morning when you came out to go to work, it was one of us, you know, it was one of the Donlings or the Freedmans, you know, and if your window was broken and your change was stolen out of your, you know, your little cigarette ashtray in your car, it was probably one of my stepbrothers, you know, and so we started to steal. I loved to steal growing up. I wasn't a master criminal or a thief, but I was slimy, you know. And I loved going into stores and with a book bag and just filling it with stuff, you know, and just walking right out. Sometimes I look right at the people that were working there and just walk right out, you know. And I wasn't even stealing necessarily to get stuff. Sometimes I was. But usually I was stealing because I got a certain feeling from doing that. There was like a thrill involved with it, you know, that made me feel good, like I was getting over. And so even before I found alcohol, I mean, it was like I was looking for, I mean, I just never felt right, you know, and I had to find some way to feel okay. And I, you know, I wanted to impress my older brother and my stepbrothers. And this one time we were out, and we were kind of like in a gang. We were armed, you know, with like gang fight type stuff, but we were in the suburbs and nobody wanted to fight us. So we're just kind of walking around with like billy clubs at like 1 o'clock in the morning and in suburbia. And I saw this Mercedes-Benz hood ornament, and at the time I was like stealing Mercedes-Benz hood ornaments, and I had sold like one of them to a kid in school, and so I thought maybe I could do that again. And so I started trying to steal this hood ornament, but it wouldn't come off. And then I was in a giant parking lot, and my stepbrothers and my brother were like, this is not a good idea. But I really wanted that acceptance. So I'm going for it, you know, I'm yanking at this thing, and it's not coming off. And all of a sudden, the woman who owned the car came out, and she was done grocery shopping. So she's in the parking lot, you know, running and screaming, because she just sees this teenager on her, or I was like 12. On her car, you know, and she's screaming, and she's a heavy set lady, so I figured I could take her, you know. So I looked up and said, oh, you know, shit, and I ran and started booking, and my stepbrother Ryan had broken his leg at the time, so he was crutching, you know. He was like a skater, so he like messed up and broke his leg, so he's crutching. My brother Dave is running, we're all running, and running from this lady, and she had this 18-year-old kid who was like a track star or something. I didn't know that. And so I see him coming after us, and I was like, you know, this guy's not gonna stop chasing me until he catches one of us. So I was like, I'll just stop, you know. I got tired, so I just stopped. He took me down and, you know, wrestled me to the ground, and it was a little violent, you know, understandably. Called the police. I got arrested. There's really not much to that story, actually. I just like telling it because it's my criminal record. It's the only time I ever got busted. So if you thought you were hearing a badass tonight, that's it. There you go. I had to do 12 hours community service, you know. So I'm the kind of guy that needed a drink when I started drinking. You know, my older brother, Dave, he started drinking a little while before me. But he didn't introduce me to alcohol, you know. And I mean, I never really drank with him. But I always looked up to that, you know. So I knew there was something in drinking and getting high. And they were all smoking pot and stuff at that time. My brother really liked drinking. And so I started with some of my friends when I was 14. And I just remember this really crazy guy that was willing to buy a couple of underage kids alcohol, bought us some quarts of King Cobra malt liquor. It was 99 cents a quart, you know, probably still is. And I remember sitting underneath this bridge behind all of you liquors, drinking this Court, and this stuff tastes like rat piss, and I'm like, why do people even do this, you know? And I got like halfway to three quarters of the way down that Court, and I just started to, feel good, really good. And I thought, I can't believe this only costs a dollar. You know what I mean? Like, wow. You know, I mean, like, talk about getting your money's worth. You know, I mean, it's like you get a bag of chips or this, you know, how I feel right now. And I loved alcohol. You know, and I loved alcohol for that reason. You know, and I don't have to explain it to you. If you're here, you probably know, you know. And as a good friend of mine's old-timer in our group, Frank, says, you know, he's like, you love drinking? You like it? Makes you feel really good? Makes you happy? You know, does it for you? You're probably going to die. You know what I mean? That's the message. Welcome to AA. You know, I'm glad you're here. But I love drinking. And the reason I love it is because I got something from alcohol that most people don't get, you know. And I don't know if most people grow up feeling like they're always apart from, feeling isolated from the rest of the world, feeling just generally terrible. You know, Ray O'Keefe used to say, you know, alcoholics just feel bad, you know, but that's how I felt. And when I drank, that went away, you know. And I didn't, it's like the doctor's opinion says, you know, that we don't drink for escape. You know, when it's talking about the craving. But I didn't drink for escape. I drank to fit in. I drank to feel a part of. You know, and that's what alcohol gave me. You know, I wasn't so self-conscious. I wasn't so worried about what I was going to say. I just kind of I felt like I was right where I was supposed to be. You know, you ever feel that way in AA? Like you get to a meeting and you hear a good speaker. Probably not this meeting, but you hear a good speaker, or you know, you share something that's been making you crazy. You get something off your chest. Or maybe, God forbid, maybe you help somebody after the meeting, and you drive home, and you get that sense of, I'm doing what I'm. I had that last night, you know. I had a kind of a rough day. Nothing externally was going wrong at all, but just inwardly, I just felt so tight, and tense, and nervous, and anxious. And you know, I had a couple of people I sponsor over, and we had dinner, and then we had a little meeting at my house, and I shared as honestly as I could, and I tried to help the people that I sponsor. And then I went to a party at a friend of mine's house last night, and there was a new girl there who had just gotten back from drinking, and we had been talking right before she drank, and I just did what I could to try and be helpful to her and to someone else that I know that was struggling. And when I was driving home, I felt that sense of, you know, everything's all right. Like, things are okay. I'm going to be okay. I feel good. And that's what drinking did for me, you know, except I didn't have to do anything to get there, you know. And a friend of mine says, you know, alcohol gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a goddamn thing, you know, and that's why I drank. And I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, which wasn't real often. I was never a daily drinker. I also didn't limit it to the weekends. I mean, I was 14, so who gives a shit about weekends? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I drank whenever my friends were drinking, or whenever I could get it, or whenever I could convince someone, or whenever, you know, we could steal it from somewhere. And I was not a top shelf type drinker. I was a Mickey's King Cobra type guy. And then I found bourbon, which is my true love. And I love bourbon because. Well, first off, it'll get you there much quicker than Mickey's, and second off, I drank outdoors a lot. You know, I mean, I was a kid when I was drinking, 14, 15 years old, usually I was drinking outside in the woods, like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, in December in D.C. or in Baltimore, sorry. And it gets cold, and bourbon will warm you up. And I drank this stuff called Evan Williams bourbon, which looks like Jack Daniels, but not quite. You know what I mean? It's like a little cheaper. And I'm a bargain shopper, you know. Because I stole every dollar I ever drank or drugged on, every cent of it. You know, I'd have little jobs, but I'd get fired for stealing from them. You know, my primary source of funds was my mother's purse. You know, And I would start stealing a couple bucks or $5 or $20 to get a bottle, and you know, maybe a little bag of pod, maybe a couple of donuts, you know what I mean? And then I would, that progressed, you know, $5, $10, $20, and then it started to be $50, and then it was $100, and then it was $200, and, you know, and I went from drinking and having fun with my friends and sneaking out to getting caught, you know, and I'd get caught in a couple times in rapid succession, and then I would start just running out or walking out, you know, and I went from kind of being nice to my family as much as I could so that I could do what I wanted behind their back to screaming and cussing in front of my mother, you know, F you know what you are, you're, you know, and that's how I talked to my mom, you know, who loved me, who always loved me. My dad, who always went out of his way to be a big part of my life, I just cut him out as much as I could, you know, because I couldn't stand to talk to him, you know. Because I was the kind of guy, towards the end of my drinking, I'd walk by a mirror, and I, if I catch my glance, I would think, you're a miserable piece of shit, you know. And that I wouldn't be able to walk by a mirror and not have that kind of resonate in my head, you know. And my head had gotten loud by this time. And I never wanted to hurt my family, you know. I never wanted to be the problem child or the one that everyone paid attention to. I didn't want to be a failure. I didn't, you know, I didn't want any of those things to happen. But that doesn't matter, you know. If you're in AA, what you want has had nothing to do with your life, your entire life. You know what I mean? Because things just tended to happen to me when I was out there drinking. And I started going to these clubs that opened up at 10 o'clock at night, shut down at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know. And when you've got a curfew, that doesn't work. So I did a lot of rebelling towards my family so I could go out and party as much as I wanted to. And I did a lot of stealing. And that started to create a lot of tension inside of me because I love my family, but I couldn't stop and I couldn't stay sober for any period of time. And I'd try to stay sober, but I'd wind up, you know, in my car, or not my car, I didn't drive, but in somebody's car, you know, headed to downtown Baltimore. Like, how did I get here, you know? I was going to stay sober, you know, and I'll try next time. I'll do it better next time. Yeah. And so I lived like that for a couple of years. And by the time I was 17, I was like that stray dog that you let in, you know what I mean? Just stay in the garage, you know? I mean, my family let me live with them, but I really wasn't a part of my family at all. I was 100% self-centered, 100% taker, you know, all the time. And I was pretty unhappy, as anyone who thinks about themselves all the time will be pretty unhappy. And I didn't think that it was ever going to get any better. I remember walking outside of this club in downtown Baltimore. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning, and maybe like 5:30, and because I remember it was light out, so the sun was up at least a little bit. And I remember walking up to this gas station and going in to get a soda for breakfast. And this guy comes in, and he's wearing a suit and tie, and he gets a newspaper, pays for his gas, gets a cup of coffee, leaves, you know, which actually is not unusual. Believe it or not, it happens in gas stations every day. And I remember looking at this guy and thinking, it's never going to be me, you know. And I wasn't thinking, I'm not going to be a sucker, you know, like that, like this guy who's got to go to work for a living. I was the sucker, and I knew it, you know what I mean? And I just remember thinking, you're never going to have a normal life, you know? You're never going to pull out of this, you know? This isn't a slump or a phase. It's not like I'm going to get it together and go to college, you know what I mean? I'm failing at a special ed in high school, you know? And it wasn't like a wake-up call for me. You know, if you're an alcoholic, that's not a wake-up call. You know, that was just the way it was. That's just the way it was. And shortly thereafter, I had this misunderstanding with this drug dealer. He gave me a bunch of drugs and said, "Go sell these drugs." And I heard, go do these drugs and worry about how you're going to pay me later. And I mean, I did a lot of drugs when I was out there drinking. I hope that doesn't offend anybody. You know, I wasn't thinking about A's primary purpose when I was doing coke. You know what I mean? I was just out there doing everything I could get my hands on. And that's what happened when I was out there. And so I ended up having to ask my family for this money, and I did. And my dad came over to give it to me, and he gave me the money, and then he smacked me in the face, and he wrestled me to the ground, and he said, "What are you doing to our family?" You know, on the lawn, not thinking he didn't care about the neighbors. That was my mom's house; he didn't live there, so. I remember that kind of shook me up, and I went inside, and I mean, at the time I acted all indignant, you know, how dare you? But I walked inside and I asked my mom if she could help get me into a treatment center, and she was like, "No problem," you know. Opened the phone book, and the next day I was at Oakview Treatment Center because I wanted to get sober, you know, and I really wanted to be sober. But I didn't understand what it meant to be powerless, you know. I thought that I'd go into this place for a month, and they teach me whatever I need to know, and then I leave, you know. And people brought meetings in there and stuff, and I related. But within a week, I broke out of that place. After a couple of days, I had this anxious feeling that I probably wasn't going to make it. And then somebody was talking about breaking out, and I thought, I could break out. And then they changed their mind, but I didn't, you know. And so I grabbed the cutest girl that was willing to come with me and split and went to a payphone and called some people until somebody picked me up. And they picked me up, and then I went over to my friend Ashley's house, who one time coming off heroin stayed at an Oxford house that's like three doors down from where I live right now, ironically enough. But she never made it, at least as far as I know. And so I went over to my friend Shannon and Ashley's house, and you know, and everyone was there getting loaded, and pretty soon I was loaded. And the minute that I felt that relief, I remember thinking, you can't even go a week. You can't even make it for 1 week in rehab, you know. And something happened to me. There was some kind of shift where my whole life, I had followed the path of least resistance, and my whole life that path of least resistance had wound up meaning me drinking and, you know, doing drugs and partying and avoiding responsibility. And all of a sudden it was like a wake-up call, like, I can't do this anymore, you know. Not like I need to get sober or I can't drink anymore because my life is real bad. It was like, I really mean it. I couldn't. It says in the big book, seemingly he couldn't drink even if he would, you know. And I don't know what that means, you know, because I hit a bottom, you know. And something happened to me that night where I was given a desire to stay sober, you know, a desire to stop drinking. And I don't know why. I'm one of the lucky ones. But it won't keep you sober, but it got me sober. And then the next day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, shortly after that, I got myself a sponsor, and the first sponsor I had was probably perfect for me at the time. He spent a couple of months teaching me how to play spades and taking me to meetings and introducing me to people, and I had a lot of fun in early sobriety. I had a lot of fun. I wasn't really comfortable, and I didn't really look at myself at all, but I had a good time, and I got to know a lot of good guys in the program, and I made some friends, and I started hanging out, and I realized, I started to learn that that you can have fun sober, you know, that going out and drinking is not the only way to have a good time, you know. And but eventually, when you learn that lesson, it's time to find someone to take you through the steps. And I did that in my first year. After a couple of months, probably 3 or 4 months, I decided to get a sponsor who would walk me through the steps, someone who had that experience, you know. So my sponsor at the time was a couple of years sober, and he was on his 4-step, which was 180 pages, longer than the big book. So I found someone who showed me how to write a 4-step out of the big book. you know, short. And I walked through the steps with that guy, you know. And I did that fourth and fifth step and realized that I wasn't as alone and isolated and different as I'd always thought I was, you know. I knew I belonged in AA from the minute I got here. I knew that you were my people. I'd sit in the meetings and I would relate. And people were talking about stuff that I've been thinking and feeling my whole life. And I knew I was at home. But I really didn't feel like... Well, I had this sense that if you knew me, if you really knew what I did out there, you know, you wouldn't like me. Like, you're being nice to me now, but if you knew me, you wouldn't accept me, you know? And I sat down with a man and I told him pretty much everything that I was terrified to ever tell anyone. And he accepted me, you know? And that's what I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I've shared honestly, at any point, I've been accepted, you know? Not sure if I'd get that from a priest or from, you know, a therapist or whatever. I mean, you know, but I've gotten that from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And people have reached out their hand to me, you know. When I had about 5 years sober, I wound up moving to the D.C. area. I lived in Jersey, in South Jersey, for a couple of years. I was in the military and very full of myself, very in love with myself, very, you know, like just... I liked to hear myself talk, and you know, I'd share in pretty much every meeting I'd go to, and you know, I'd sponsor people, and you know, they would talk for 5 minutes, and I'd talk for 20, you know, kind of like that. And I moved to the D.C. area, and I started going to meetings in Midtown Group, my group, and the first time I came to Midtown, Clancy spoke, and I was like, this is a good meeting, you know? I didn't know it wasn't like that every week. And so I started coming back. And eventually I found a sponsor because I had gotten to a place in my sobriety. The 12 and 12 talks about our sobriety getting to a place where it can seem dull and gray and kind of like sobriety isn't really paying off, you know? And I really relate to that. And I've reached that point since that time. But I was going through one of these gray periods of my sobriety, and I started to see a therapist because I thought that AA maybe wasn't enough. And I went to this meeting, and my sponsor talked, and he said, some people might need therapy, medication. And I had just gotten a prognosis from my therapist that I was going to have to be on something for the rest of my life for my depression. And some people might need that, just like my sponsor said. But he said, I'm an alcoholic, and this is what I've always needed. This has always treated my depression, you know, because I have alcoholic depression, you know. And I said, shit, maybe that's what I have, you know. And I asked him to sponsor me, you know, because I wanted to try AA in the way that he was doing AA. And I found out I do have alcoholic depression because I spent the next six months being more depressed than I'd ever been in my entire life. It was like, once I got this guy to be my sponsor, he was nice to me for a little while. But trust me, just long enough to reel me into where I didn't think I was. You know, once they get you by your ass, you know, so you have no choice but to do what they say, then you get the hammer, you know. And he was not like a surgeon. He was like a construction worker, you know. But he would hang up on me all the time. I'd call him and tell him what I was doing, and he'd say, well, you should have probably called me before you decided to do that. Like, you know what I mean? And I hear that, like, operator, you know, if you'd like to make a call, and I think, did that just happen? You're like, did we get cut off? I lived on the high rise of the 26th story of this 26-story building, and I had associated with that with success because I was so egotistical, you know. I mean, I was just so in love with myself, but crazy as hell, and thinking about killing myself. And I was in the car with him one time, and I said, Jack, I've been thinking about taking my life. And he said, I think you should do it. You're the most self-centered person I've ever met. All you think about is yourself and your feelings. I'd want to kill myself if I were you, too. and you have my permission, you know. I took psychology in high school. I knew that you're not supposed to say that. You know? They tell you if someone's talking about killing themselves, don't tempt them, don't threaten them. And I felt very threatened. You know? And, he was calling me. He was calling. I mean, my sponsor had and has the ability to know exactly where I'm going. If I'm not giving him the whole truth, he's going to get it. You know, I mean, he was like an interrogator. And I really thought that he hated me, you know, when I was first being sponsored by him. And I later found out I was right. You know, he did hate me. He hated sponsoring me. He just told me a couple of months ago. He reminded me. He said, "You're one of the most difficult people I ever had to sponsor." Because you were so belligerent, but at the same time, you were willing to call me regularly so I couldn't just ignore you like the other people that I sponsor that aren't willing, you know. And, you know, but he didn't think about my feelings. He thought about what he could do to help me, you know. And some of the time that he was yelling at me, I'd like to, you know, stand up here and say it was all for my own good. Some of the time he was genuinely pissed. You know, he was really frustrated. And I've sponsored people like that. That's how I know that, you know. Sometimes it's like, this is what you need. And sometimes it's like, you're really pissing me off. You know what I mean? And so I got some of that humanness, too. But he's a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he's busier than I am in AA, and he's still busier than I am in AA. He hasn't slowed down. He's coming up on 20 years next month, and he sped up, actually. That's the truth. And I'm still running and trying to catch up with him. And you know, my sponsor and I don't see eye to eye on everything, you know, but concerning sobriety and concerning the things that are really important, we see eye to eye. Or I pretend, you know. It's the truth. I'm allowed to have my opinions, but when it comes down to it, I better fall in line, you know. I better have someone that I don't think I'm smarter than, you know. If you think you're smarter than your sponsor, you got the wrong sponsor, you know. And I've got one that I can follow, and that I talk to, and I tell him the truth, at 100%, you know. And I don't hold anything back, you know. There are times when I come to him with the same thing for months and months, and he'll say something like, "Look, don't talk to me about this anymore." And in that case, if it comes up again, I don't necessarily talk to him about it anymore. You know, maybe I'll talk to somebody else. But if there's something going on that has to do with my inventory and my sobriety, he knows about it. You know, and sometimes I gotta fess up, and sometimes he just knows about it, you know. Sometimes he knows about it from other people. I walked up to him at a meeting one time, and I had been practicing behavior that was affecting other people in a negative way. We'll just leave it at that. And affecting him, right, because he's hearing about it. And I walked up to him at a meeting to tell him, and he said, "Your selfishness is already beating you here today. Better luck next time." I just turned around and walked away. And I was like, "Shit!" You know? The worst thing about being in AA and being in an active group is sometimes someone will beat you to your sponsor, you know? And the AA Gazette, you know? Delivers even on Sundays, you know what I mean? And so I've gotten a little of that too. But he helped me to feel small enough to stay here, to stay small enough to stay here, you know, and I need that. I'm an egotistical maniac, you know, and my ego tortures me and affects me and separates me from God and me from you and me from anything that's good in my life, and yet it's irresistible to me, you know. I keep coming back to it over and over again, and I got a sponsor that loves me and accepts me. And usually he's not like a tyrant. The truth is, most of the time we talk, usually he's very nice, very supportive. You know, I mean, I was really crazy on Tuesday. I had, me and my girlfriend weren't getting along, and we were in the middle of Las Vegas, and it was just the two of us. And guess what? It's just the two of us, you know what I mean? And we weren't talking, so I wasn't happy. She was making sure I wasn't happy. But I called him, you know, when she was in CVS, like, getting some water. I was like, "Okay, I have, like, a minute here." And we were on our way to a meeting, and I called him up, and I let him know what I did and what happened and the situation. And, And he was like, man, it sounds like you're beating yourself up a little bit. Just take it easy. Try and be thoughtful. You know, so it's not like I have like some like tyrant. It's like, I mean, this guy loves me, you know, and I'm so grateful that I have people like that in my life. People who know everything about me and that really accept me anyway, you know. Because I'll tell you, in my sobriety, at several different points, I've had difficult times, you know. And if you're an AA and you're here for the long haul, you're going to have some difficult times, you know. The Big Book talks about certain trials and low points, or trials and pitfalls, you know. Certain, that word certain is there. If you're here, you know, you're going to have certain trials and pitfalls ahead. And I've had my share. You know, sometimes I think I've had my share and your share, you know. But I've definitely had my share. And recently I've been going through that. I've been going through a tough time the last couple of months. I just, you know, it's not like I've stopped calling my sponsor or stopped doing the actions that we take here to make us comfortable. But sometimes we take the actions here and all we get is sober, you know. And lately I've felt like that. Like, I'm doing what I can, but my self-centeredness is on me, like that alien from Aliens, you know, it's right here. And I, sometimes I feel like there's nothing I can do to get away from it. And I pray, and I go to meetings, and I talk to newcomers, and I do the things we've been taught to do. And sometimes I still feel that angst, that anxiousness, you know what I mean? And I can't get it off of me. But it's times like these that I learn what it means to have faith in a higher power. It hasn't always been this way. It's not always going to be this way, you know. And it's funny, you know, at the same time that I'm kind of going through this period where I'm pretty uncomfortable, someone I sponsor is going through the same thing. And so we're just checking in with each other every day. You know, she calls and she's like, it's still bad. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going through it too, you know. And so, you know, I was sharing in a meeting, because I had some serious drinking thoughts a couple of weeks ago, like some strong. It wasn't like I drove by a liquor store and it caught my eye. It was like I really had a desire to drink, and it was a difficult experience. And I, you know, when you've got 13 years, it's embarrassing to talk about something like that. But I went to a meeting over at a friend of mine's house. He was sick, so he couldn't get out. So we brought a meeting to his house, and I got honest. Everyone in the meeting got honest. It was like a cry fest, a bunch of dudes. You know what I mean? In fact, I had a new guy with me. He had like a week, and he's like, "I thought only women did this." You know what I mean? Like, welcome to AA. I talked about how I was really struggling. And I was thinking about taking a drink. I had gotten the idea in my head that, you know, my drinking was a phase, or that it wasn't that bad, or that, you know, maybe it would be okay to go out and drink again. And that's a dangerous thought for an alcoholic. And sometimes I'm powerless to get rid of that thought, you know, because I'm powerless over alcohol. An old timer, the guy who we were visiting, he's got about 20 years. He got sober at 18. He said, and, you know, he said it, of course, everything he says I relate to, and he started talking about his drinking, and then he said, you know, so the one difference is, in AA, we've always got somebody to go through it with, you know? And how true that's been for me in my life, you know? I've been sober now four times longer than I drank. I drank from 14 to 17, and now I'm 30. I've spent, you know, my later teen years and all my 20s in AA. And I've gone through things that have been just as painful as some things I went through in my drinking. But I've never had to go through anything alone, you know. Not for a minute, you know. At 1 o'clock in the morning, people have been there to pick up the phone for me. And I've been there to answer the phone for others, you know. I've been there to talk to other people. And there's such a power here, you know. Such a power that we can tap into if we're willing. And so far, I've been crazy as hell in AA, but I've always run to AA for my solution and not away from it. And I don't know why that is, but I've been lucky like that. But I'm grateful. So thank you for having me out to speak. Thanks for having me share.
We have a nice way of closing.